All right. Good morning. Y'all ready to get started? All right. Let's finish the material for the strategically small church. This class is actually a continuation of last week's class on resilience. It's very different from the first two classes that we did where the material was more focused on church dynamics and the life of the church. This is more of a tool for organizations. So you can, we'll certainly apply this here, but in your business, other groups that you're a part of, this is applicable pretty much across the board. In fact, the book that a lot of this material is based on is Andrew Zolli's Resilience, and he studies all kinds of groups. He studies businesses. Interestingly enough, one of the groups that he studied were terrorist groups, talking about why do they keep popping up, and some of it is because of resilience, singularity of purpose, all of that sort of thing. And so, certainly not saying, well, let's be like them. It's not that. It's more what makes a group resilient. And so, we'll talk some more about that today. Just again, to get the definition out on the table, resilience is the capacity of a system, enterprise, or a person to maintain its core purpose and integrity in the face of dramatically changed circumstances. I've gotten quite a few emails from friends around the country who preach in family-sized churches. That is, churches from 50 to 150 to 200. And almost without fail, every single one of them that has been emailing me has said, this stuff that you're doing, because we've put it on our website and it's on the ACU Summit stuff as well, they said, everything that you're talking about applies to where we are. I'm thinking about teaching one of these classes at my church. And I was like, go for it. Do it. Smaller groups need this material because of the situation that we live in. You know, in most of our size churches, we sit in the shadows of megachurches. And so whether you're here or up in New England, you still have that comparison to make. And what a lot of this material is aimed at doing is saying, you know, while that comparison is there, it's not necessary. Play to your strengths. Be who you are. Live out the mission of the kingdom of God wherever you happen to be, and live it. Just be yourself. It's not to say that, well, we're averse to growth, we don't want to grow. That's not it at all. It's to say, start where you are and don't make comparisons, because they're really two very different worlds. And so to friends of mine listening online, or if you are in smaller churches, let this be a word of encouragement to you, and especially this material on resilience. By taking the definition, it raises a couple of questions. Number one, does my church have a clearly stated purpose and or mission? If it does not, if it doesn't have a clearly stated purpose, if it's, well, we're just church because I grew up going to church and this is what we are supposed to do, hit the pause button right now, go figure out your purpose, and then come back to the material. Because if you don't have a clearly stated purpose and asking the question all the time, why are we here, then all of this other stuff is really going to be secondary. But once you state, here is our mission in the life of a church, then you can move on to the next one. And that is my church carrying out that mission in the face of dramatically changing circumstances? That one is critical, because what it does is that it takes the definition and it pushes it through a very specific filter. And that is when you try to do church without acknowledging that we live in a culture where things are changing all of the time, then it's you're not going to be able to continue that purpose. Does that make sense? The good news is it's always been this way. It's always been changing circumstances. If you've studied history or cultural studies in any way, shape, or form, you know that things have always been in a state of change. Okay? It's always been this way. The difference, however, is the type of change. And the type of change that we are living in now is a different type of change than what has existed before us in history. So if you think about, well, what are some of the changes that we're facing now that other, let's stick with the subject, churches our size have not had to deal with in the past, then I would say there's two primary ones. You're welcome to add to these. In fact, whenever we open this to discussion, you can say, well, here's another change, but here are the two big ones that are really irrefutable. Technology is one primary one. It is changing faster than it's ever changed in history. This is not to say that there's never been technological change in the past. You go study the aqueducts of the Roman Empire. That was a technological change. Huge technological change. All right? But the way, the speed at which technology is changing and the way it's driving our access to information is different than it's ever been. So that's kind of one huge one. And if the church, it is, if churches are not willing to address that, then, you know, we're the ship is going to sail without us. All right? The other big one that is pretty irrefutable is globalization. That's just a fact of life that we're dealing with now. Our world has shrunk extremely over the last 20 to 50 years. That is, access to people around the world, but also the way that for us, let's just stick with our setting here in, you know, Gulf Coast, Texas, and people listening all over the country can probably cite it for them as well. But we take Houston, and the level of globalization in the Houston metro area, who we are now compared to, say, what Houston looked like 50 years ago, is dramatically changed. All right? So again, in taking Zoli's definition and saying, how does this fit with the life of our church, we have a core purpose, and the goal is to maintain that core purpose, but also to say we're doing it in dramatically changing circumstances. So those are big ones to deal with. Once you identify that purpose, you do it with a commitment to consistency. That is, in spite of everything changing around us, can we maintain a specific purpose? For our goals, it's, you know, love God, serve people. No matter what changes are all around us, can we maintain that as a specific goal? Can we remember every time we come together and then when we leave this place and go out and be salt and light in the world, can we remember and always keep as a central focus, this is who we are. We are people who are shaped in the image and likeness of Christ. And everyone we meet, our life is to be about sharing our lives as people who have been changed and shaped in the image and likeness of Christ. No matter what happens in the world around us, that never has to change. And so, again, as a core purpose with a commitment to consistency, that stays the same. But once we identify these changes that are around us, and, you know, the technology and globalization are just big picture topics, but once we identify those changes, can we put things in place in the life of our church that are going to build and cultivate resilience? That is, can we maintain our core purpose and be resilient no matter what those changes are that we face? So those are some of the big picture questions that we talked about last week. So to move this forward into kind of the next step for this week, there are three components that build group resilience, okay? Kind of three keys, let's say, for the life of our church that can help us build resilience for the days and years to come. Number one, it's what Zoli calls the power of clusters. Number two, quantity time, and that's an important one to emphasize, and we will. And then number three, what he calls the resilient mind, not just, you know, my resilient mind, but can we as a group, and this is hard when you talk about organizations, but can we as a group have a commitment to resilience that we all are thinking about at the same time. Now, let me pause here and say, one of the reasons that it's easier to do this and set things in place that do this in the life of a family-sized church, why it's easier to do that in a family-sized church than it is in a larger program-sized church, is mainly because of number three. It is harder, the larger your group gets, to all maintain together a singularity of purpose and a singularity of mind. And so, again, this is not sour grapes. It's not to say that we're better than program-based churches. They serve a wonderful place in the kingdom, and they serve a lot of people who need that. That's fine. Don't have any problems with that. But pulling off number three, the larger you get, it becomes more and more difficult, and then it gets impossible. You have to become something else. And so why this is so good for smaller family-sized churches, a lot of it has to deal with number three, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, number one, power of clusters. When I taught this material at ACU, I, of course, used us as an example. We are a family-sized church. That is, we are a cluster. We are a niche group. But we are also unique in that we are a niche group in one of the largest cities in the United States. So we are a small, tight-knit, family-sized church, but it's not like a small, family-sized church in West Texas, right? Where everybody not only knows everybody, but you run into each other at the post office all the time and at the grocery store. When I lived in Monday, if I had to go get a gallon of milk at the grocery store, I would tell Jen I'll be back in an hour. You know, and I could walk to the grocery store. It was two blocks from the parsonage. Why would I be gone an hour? Well, because every time you walk into that grocery store, you know everybody. You know everybody who works there, and you pretty much are going to know everybody who's shopping in there. So there's a lot of conversation. Going to the grocery store is a social event. Well, for us, this is a different ballgame altogether. Because in order for us to spend time together, in order for our cluster to exist, outside of the Sunday morning effort, the key word there is intentionality. We have to be intentional about seeing each other outside of these Sunday morning hours. So the power of clusters exists in a very different way for us than, say, it would in West Texas. So when Zoli talks about clusters, when he talks about how do these groups that build resilience do what they do, one of the things that he points out is a comparison between cities. And the two cities that he makes comparison between are New York City and Detroit. Okay, so if you know anything about cultural studies and U.S. history when it comes to large cities, you already know where this is going. Right? So how does a large city continue to get larger? Right? New York City is landlocked. Right? So how does it continue to grow when it can't expand outward? Right? This is very different than Houston. You know, Houston started with a loop. You know, 610 was the outskirts of the city not that long ago. So how is it that Conroe and almost Huntsville are being taken up into the Houston, Galveston metro area? How is Katy, you know, there's no space, there's no country between us and Katy. Katy has been, you know, sucked into the Houston, Galveston metro area. Well, New York City is very different than that. So how has New York City not only maintained its size, but it continues to grow? Well, what Zoli has studied is these clusters, these niche communities, that within New York City, there are hundreds and potentially thousands of clusters. If you live in Brooklyn Heights, for example, just outside Manhattan. It is feasible that you could go weeks, months, even years living in a small area of Brooklyn Heights and never have to leave that area. You'd never have to leave it. You know, you might go to a show on Broadway occasionally, but you don't have to. You can survive in that. Well, when he compares that to the history of Detroit, what he said was that Detroit was pretty one-dimensional in its history. And so it did not have clusters built in around it. And so what happened when the auto industry began to crater? The city was hurt dramatically. And so it started caving in on itself. And so if you want to read more of that, Zoli goes into much more detail, but just as a snapshot, he compares these two cities as a way of describing the power of clusters and then what happens when you don't maintain kind of a niche community. And so one of the things that I said back when I taught this material and that we can talk about more here is that we exist, you know, in an enormous city as a niche community. This is just who we are. We are a unique, family-sized Church of Christ in Houston. And so what makes us unique? It's not the family dynamic. You could go to a lot of other small, family-sized churches in Houston and probably find some pretty close-knit groups of people. And so if we're talking specifically in Churches of Christ, some of the things that make us unique, one is kind of a commitment to freedom and people being able to come in here and be themselves. You come in here, we want you to bring your gifts and your talents to the table. If you are a man, if you're a woman, if you're a child, you can come in here and play to your strengths and share with the life of the church. One of the things that David Thompson and I have talked about quite a bit about one of the things that makes our church unique is not just that men and women get to participate fully in the life of the church across the board, but when you see children participating in worship, that in many respects is even more unique. You know, and so there's these little things that when you walk in here, there are hallmarks that say, this is not, my father's Oldsmobile. This is a little different. And for some, that takes some getting used to. But, again, cultivating that niche community is important. So one of the things that Zoli found, critical factor of community as a main strength of clusters, a couple of quotes. Whenever we found strong social resilience, we also found strong communities. That is, if you have a group of people who are resilient, who can maintain their identity in the face of dramatically changing circumstances, most of the time it happened because people were pretty tight-knit. You know, the niche community had some good family ties. And then he says, we found resilient communities frequently relied as much on informal networks rooted in deep trust to contend with and heal disruption. This one is critical. In fact, that quote may be kind of worth the price of admission for these four sections of this class. Because what he points out is not just the informal networks, that is, you don't have rigid leadership structures, but you have leadership structures that are fairly fluid and ever-changing. I'll come back to that one in a second. But this whole rooted in deep trust thing is the key to resilience. It's everything. Because one of the things that I said last week that we'll reiterate this week is that if there is conflict in the life of our church, if there's ever conflict in the life of our church, would you rather be in conflict with a friend or a stranger? Would you rather be in conflict with a friend or an adversary? Because if you go into conflict with someone that you trust, with someone that you've put your feet under their table, or you've gone out to eat together a bunch of times, or you were there when their baby was born and you held that baby and prayed over that baby. That changes the game. Right? That is a totally different thing than you have an enormous organization and that organization is built around rigid leadership structures, and it's built more around the organization itself than around personal relationships. Does that make sense? This, again, is why Zoli's material on resilience works better for small cluster groups than it does for enormous organizations. So, to kind of wrap up before the second point, the primary tendency toward resilience for the strategically small church lies in the great possibility that we actually know each other and trust each other during disruptions. Again, this is key for the life of a family-sized church who wants to cultivate resilience. Because sometimes when you have a smaller family-sized church that's not cultivating these things and talking about these things, is that one disruption can sink the whole ship. But if we're thinking about these things and talking about these things constantly, then it's going to put resiliency in place to deal with any of these disruptions that might happen. Number two is a lot less complex. Right? The clusters thing takes a while to unpack. Quantity time, this is a one-slide point. It's like bringing up children. When you bring up children, because you'll remember back a couple of decades ago when people were saying you need quality time with your kids. If you're only able to spend 30 minutes a day with them, give them 30 minutes of uninterrupted attention. Now, what we have learned in social studies and social dynamics is that that sounded really good, but it don't work. It doesn't work. 30 minutes a day is not enough. They need quantity time. They need time to unwind. They need road trips, one-on-one, sitting next to you in the car where they may not say anything for the first hour. And then all of a sudden, you know, now that they know that this trip is going to take 6 hours, they start talking. You need quantity time. This is also important for a family-sized church, and this goes back to the intergenerational strength. When, you know, an older couple spends time with a younger couple, when a woman in her 70s spends time with a woman in her 30s and 40s, that moment, all right, just a one-on-one thing, maybe you went out to lunch together. Maybe you have a hobby that you share and you just wind up spending time together. Well, guess what happens next time the younger couple who spent the day with the older couple comes into Bearing on a Sunday morning? Guess what happens? Their connection is not just because, well, we go to church together and we see each other on Sunday morning. It's rooted in relationship. And as simple as this sounds, it is one of the most important things in the life of a family-sized church. And that is, once we have spent that time together, once we've had an experience together, guess what happens on Sunday morning? It builds resilience. So that when those disruptions, back to point number one, when those disruptions happen, they happen within relationship, rather than just within the life of an organization. So, like I said, point two, pretty simple. Point three, however, is another one, though, that takes a little bit to unpack, and that's what Zoli calls the resilient mind. I'll give you a few examples. There was some work done a couple of years ago. Some of you may have read the thing that Jen put together as a part of her work, this 21 Days of Gratitude. So for 21 days, at the end of each one of those 21 days, you list three things a day for which you're grateful. Simple as that. And it can be little things. I was grateful for, a walk around the neighborhood when I got home from work. I was grateful for a good lunch. I was grateful for a phone call that just kind of made my day. You do that for 21 days, and it actually rewires the way that you think. It actually rewires so that at the end of that 21 days, even without thinking about it, you're starting to look at the world through lenses that are more in line with gratitude than maybe perhaps that you did at the beginning of the 21 days. Now, the bad news is that the research that's been done on this from social scientists suggests more that it takes 66 days and not just 21. So it may take a little bit longer, but that is one practice that builds this resilient mind. One that you may have seen if you're on Instagram is this 100 days of happiness, that you take a picture every day of something that makes you happy. And for 100 days in a row, your feed basically shows 100 things for which you are happy. And then one of the things that we have been doing that can be helpful for a church is to build themes into the life of the church. And so for 2013, it was more focused on gratitude. For 2014, it was about dreaming together, dreaming the dreams of God, trying to figure out what are things that God dreams about, what can we dream about together in looking toward the future. 2015 is going to be joy, but don't tell anybody, that's a secret. So that's just between us for the next couple of weeks. Us and the entire internet, but who's counting? One of the few times that Zoli mentions religion is along these lines of the resilient mind. And again, one of the few times he mentions religion, what he says is that religious belief tends to be better at cultivating adaptive communities and people. Now, that is not across the board. Right? Just because you have a group centered on some sort of religion, that does not always happen. What he does say, though, is that the religious groups that are resilient tend to be more adaptive than any other group that he studied resilience. Okay, so and that's an important distinction that I want to make sure is coming across. He doesn't say religion equals resilience. What he is saying is the religious groups that are resilient are more resilient than any other organizations that he would say this is a resilient group. Does that distinction, is that connecting? Because it's real important that that point is made. So how do we, in the life of a church, cultivate resilience? I think it's really quite simple, but it takes classes like this to lay some of the implicit things out on the table in an explicit way. Making the things that aren't as obvious obvious, kind of pulling the curtains and saying, what's behind the curtains? Well, this is the main thing. A resilient church is a group that maintains purpose and hope with a focus on Jesus. Now, again, I hope that the first thing that comes to mind when you hear that is, yeah, what's so profound about that? That's the point. But what happens when a church stops saying this out loud? That is, why are we here? We are here because we are maintaining a purpose that is rooted in hope, our hope in the Lord, and we are going to constantly keep our focus in the life of the church on Jesus. That is first and foremost. You know what happens to a church when you quit saying this out loud all the time? The focus can, doesn't have to, but it can become something other than Jesus. And you know what happens in the life of a church when you stop saying, our focus is Jesus this Sunday, next Sunday, and in the years to come, that's where our focus is going to stay? What can happen is that focus swings from Jesus to church. And if you've ever been in the life of a church, when that happens, you start coming in Sunday after Sunday and something just feels a little bit off. Like, we're talking about ourselves an awful lot. And we're not talking about Jesus the way that we should. And if you've ever been there, then you probably know that coming and maintaining the focus on Jesus is better. Because one of the things that we've said over and over again, when church becomes the point of church, we miss the point of church. That's not the focus. The focus is not a dynamic. The focus is on Jesus. Here's what Zoli says is, how do you take the next step? How do you take the focus from here's where we are today, and how do we continue this into the future? Zoli says there's something that he calls rehearsing the future. It's about training, practicing, and stating a commitment to a resilient community. This is what the resilient mind really comes down to. That we, as a group of people, have a commitment to resilience. And it's not implicit. It's not something that's just kind of under the radar and some people notice it. It's about stating it out loud. This is who we are and this is what we are going to be committed to. What rehearsing the future does, that is being committed to resilience, is that it gets us ready for those moments when we go through slump times. You know? And I am so happy to be in a church that is not going through a slump time. You ever been in a church where there's a slump time? It isn't any fun. But hopefully, we will never, in the rest of history, ever go through a slump time. Is that very realistic? It's going to happen. You know, it can happen. But if you put things in place, like what we're going over here, it can help that those slump times don't have to be as, slumpy. And then one of the things that I told the church leaders that I was working with at ACU is that if your church happens to be in a slump time now, because there were plenty of church leaders that I was working with that were in slump times, again, you go back to square one. You go back to stating and restating that purpose, and don't ignore that you're doing it in the midst of change. All right, so how do you stop the negative and build resilience? And this isn't going to apply to us as much, but just to kind of say, how does all of this work during those slump times? Number one, you interrupt the contagion. Number two, you change the thinking. That is, if there is a source of conflict that is affecting the whole group, you name it. You don't act like it's not there. You name it, you interrupt it, and then you change the thinking. I've said this before, but I'll just state it again. Zoli uses the example of the car with wings. That is, you've got a group of people in a car that is hurtling towards the edge of a cliff, and everybody in the car is saying, turn around, slam on the brakes. But by that time, you realize that this isn't going to happen. The car is going to go off. And so then everybody in the car says, well, what are we supposed to do now that we're hurtling down? And they say, well, let's build a parachute, to soften the landing. And what Zoli says is, the real thinking change happens not when the car is going over the cliff and everybody is building a parachute. The change happens whenever someone in the car says, no, let's build wings and make this thing fly. So that what we are doing is not softening a landing and then landing stagnant in one place, but actually changing the whole structure so that where we go from here is not only forward, but faster and more resilient. So that's kind of the parable that Zoli says is, you have to change the thinking sometimes. And I think that we've experienced a lot of that here. You change the norms. What he calls translational leaders are already building networks within your group before you need them, so that when conflict erupts in the life of a family-sized church, you already have networks of people who love each other and trust each other, and that's already built in. Here, I said earlier something's worth the price of admission. Here for me is the one that is. It's the very last line in the book. And it's when Zoli says, resilience must continuously be refreshed and recommitted to. Every effort at resilience buys us not certainty, but another day, another chance. Every day is day one. Why this is so important in the life of a church, particularly a church that's built around relationships, is the same reason that this is true for a marriage, for example. If you ever in a marriage reach a point where you say, we have this all figured out and everything is good, and you just start coasting, it's not good. Every day when you wake up in a marriage, and this is just an example, but every day when you wake up in a marriage, you have to recommit to it over and over again. And you have lots of history. You have good memories, you have bad memories, you have good times, and you have bad times. Which is why this morning you woke up, and if you are married, you had to recommit to it all over again. It's no different in the life of a family-sized church. Every time we come together, we recommit to one another, and we recommit to us together being a community in Jesus Christ. We don't get to coast. We don't get to say, okay, we've arrived. Everything's good. We have to recommit to this every time we come together, which is precisely why my favorite thing that kind of characterizes who we are in our tradition, not only is it rooted in Scripture, but it's rooted in a lot of good memories, is that table up there. Because it's a lot easier to recommit to one another and to the Lord when we're doing something like that together than just coming together for the sake of coming together. That is one of the places that is really about singularity of purpose. So again, the definition, resilience is the capacity of a system, enterprise, or a person to maintain its core purpose and integrity in the face of dramatically changed circumstances, and I would substitute dramatically changing circumstances. So that's the whole class. Three big things: authenticity, family, and intergenerational dynamics. And then for the resilience stuff, clusters, spending time together, and having an explicit commitment to resilience. And so that leaves us a few minutes for conversation. David Pybus and Jennifer, will you just, start with... All right.
I just wanted to add something to that. Recommitting every day in the marriage or in the church, it's recommitting those practices.
Yeah.
Recommitting those practices that are resilient, like the gratitude, the being together. These are the things that we recommit. And in a marriage, it's the same thing.
Right.
It's like exercising, like going out and physically exercising. If you stop exercising, then you're not going to be physically fit anymore. So it's the same. And the other thing I wanted to say was when you said earlier, disruptions happen within relationships. They just do.
Sure.
I wanted to add a little bit of Diana Fosha's work. She's a therapist up in New York, and she works a lot with attachment with couples and with parents and children. And she said, like, a lot of times we think a healthy relationship looks like something where you have this constant connection, like we're just connected and everything's good. And if that something happens to that, then we've messed up. We didn't have the system built correctly, basically. And she said, but that's just not realistic because we're human beings. We're going to have times when we hurt each other. We're going to have times when we get home from work stressed out or come into the church and we're going through a building project or whatever. And it's going to be a time of disruption,
sure.
I like how you put that. And so she said what actually characterizes healthy relationships and healthy attachment is when you have that foundation of connection,
right,
and healthy connection, which is, I think, what you're fostering here.
Yeah.
And then the second part is that you have a rupture. And then the third part is there's a mechanism for repair.
Right.
And so that you're able to, and you have built into the system, you know, ability to forgive each other, and this just awareness that we're going to mess up sometimes, and that's part of it. So I like that planning for disruptions, or
yeah,
knowing they're going to happen, and then having those things in place, those mechanisms to create healing again.
Right. Yeah, because that ability to repair, to this point, is rooted in relationships, which is precisely why it's so important when we welcome new people into our family cluster, that we immediately start building relationships with them so that they become a part of that rather than just the newcomers. Because some groups, and you've probably experienced this, that the new people have been around for 20 years. You know, and what I love about Bearing is that that's not the case here, but it's because of a commitment to relationships, trust, and resilience. David, Linda, and then Paul.
Well, when I raised my hand, I was really wanting you to elaborate more on what you meant by a church in a slump, but we've moved on from that. I'm wondering what you think is unique about the church that contributes to these concepts here, the church as the body of Christ.
Right. What do you think? Just before, because I would like to know.
Well, I mean,
we're recording, so.
Right. I understand. I was listening to all of this, and I'm thinking, well, this sounds interesting, but it's a fairly secular sort of thing.
It is.
All of these concepts. And if you look back at the church, you can certainly look at the New Testament and beyond as a story of change and disruption,
right,
constantly having to deal with that. And the early church dealt with, you know, the big one. Well, there were so many big ones, it's hard to put a finger on which one is the big one. But clearly Jesus not coming when they thought he would, and getting to a second generation,
yeah,
having to deal with Jews and Gentiles,
right,
all kinds of changes there. And what is it about the church that makes it survive? I mean, as a Christian, I say, well, Jesus is at work there.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
Yeah.
But I also, I think there's an important thing to say about hope. I saw someone in a commentary once talk about what happens when you don't have an apocalyptic worldview, where you don't see the concept of change coming by the work of Jesus.
Right.
You think that it all depends on you, and it becomes an unbearable burden, especially when you begin to fail.
Yeah.
Whereas if you are confident that God is at work and it's going to happen, then you're never discouraged by that. You're resilient because God is here, and
right,
it's going to happen. And
yeah,
you have a hope that endures through a feeling of sometimes that you're not making a difference.
Right. The two things that I would say just to answer that initial question and then kind of paint a backdrop very quickly, is that this material is just a lens through which to see ourselves. No doubt about it. Why are, to Zoli's point, why are religious communities who are resilient better than other groups who are resilient? We would say, because what the New Testament teaches us, it's the power of God's Holy Spirit working among us. There's no question in my mind that that's one of the things that makes us more resilient. But where this material comes in handy is that why is one church, pardon the language, better at it than another church? I would say it's because this kind of material is not just taken for granted. You name it, you talk about it, you learn from it, you adapt things to your own purposes, without just saying, well, God's going to take care of it. I'm a big fan of God's going to take care of it, but there are times when you're standing on the roof and the flood is getting higher and the helicopters come and well, God's going to take care of me. You know that story, right? So there's that. To your point about what happens in the churches in the New Testament, the two that I would lay up against each other are the Corinthian church and the church or group of churches that received the book of Hebrews. Because those are two very different worlds. The Corinthian church is the one that I would characterize as the least resilient community in the New Testament. They're the church that you study on how not to do church. All right? So this business, this language that we used to use about being the New Testament church is one that's always kind of bothered me because I don't want to be Corinth by any stretch of the imagination, because they were not a resilient community. Paul was trying, but they weren't committed to resilience. The group that received the book of Hebrews was, on the other hand, because if you go through Hebrews, one of the main things that it does is that it says, look back there at people who are resilient so that you can be resilient as well. Look back there at people who depended on God so that you can depend on God as well. Because when you start getting toward the end of the book of Hebrews, what the writer keeps telling these churches over and over again is, don't give up. Keep on keeping on. Endure. You know, that's why he uses the language of, you have drooping hands and weak knees. It's because they're tired and they want to give up. But he says, keep on keeping on, because this Faith Hall of Fame didn't get to be a Faith Hall of Fame by giving up. And so he follows that Faith Hall of Fame with the language of, therefore, fix your eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. That is kind of the key. So that's my response. Linda?
Before we moved to Houston, we belonged to a very vibrant church about the same size as Bering. But shortly before we left to move to Houston, the church went into a slump, a big slump. There were a number of issues that came up. And one of the things that we noticed was that we turned inward. And I guess it was kind of the point of church is church.
Right.
We wanted to keep creating what we had, and that didn't work real well. And so when we lost several key members as a result of their passing away, we reached a tipping point.
Right.
And so 2 years after we moved here, and they lost us too,
right.
So I don't
know
if that had anything to do with it, but the church, that the body, corporate body, had to close. But one of the neat things was that those people who had learned to heal and learned new ways of thinking in the body that we were a part of immigrated to other churches.
Yeah.
And
planted health
and planted,
in those places.
Planted new ideas.
Yep.
And it kind of reminds me of the Jerusalem church when the persecution started. God didn't want them to stay in Jerusalem and become focused on that. He wanted the gospel to spread. He wanted new ideas, new ways of thinking. And that's happened.
Yeah,
and
that's
just due to God's grace.
Right. Yeah. Paul is going to take us home. Sorry, we're out of time. Well, and one of the things, to Linda's point, that many of us have had to learn the hard way in church dynamics and just church life is that if you're going to implement any kind of change, do it slowly and do one thing at a time. Because if you try to do more than one thing at a time, it causes too much disruption. All right, Paul, take us home.
Okay. I want to point, I endorse fully the saying that, you know, when the point of church becomes church, you lose the point of church. But I want to lift up one structural feature of this congregation that I think really contributes in a significant way to the quality of life in this church and to its resilience. And that feature is that we have multiple leadership teams.
Right.
and those multiple leadership teams, specifically the pastoral team and the A team, the administrative team, with each with defined functions, and each composed of men and women,
right,
who serve set terms.
Right.
So we've got term limits, they're staggered.
We don't burn people out.
So every 2 years, each team gets replenished.
Right.
And what that does over time, A, it keeps people from being burned out.
Mm-hmm.
B, it prevents or mitigates against the accumulation of too much power in too few hands. And it also creates an environment where over time you've got a significant percentage, proportion of the church membership is either serving in leadership currently,
right,
or has,
yeah,
served in leadership in the relatively recent past.
Yeah.
And what that means is that when you're dealing with issues as a church, you've got a lot of people in the church who kind of understand, if they're not in leadership right now, they understand the kinds of things that the leadership is dealing with.
Yeah, they've been there before.
They've been there. Yeah. They kind of understand what that responsibility feels like. And they have a better feel for what's realistic, what's not realistic, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And also, in among those leadership teams, you develop pretty strong relationships. Just because you're working together on a common,
yeah,
task. And you,
yeah,
serve together for several years. And yet, it's ever-changing because,
right,
every couple of years you get new people roll off, new people roll on, so you kind of reform the group.
Yep.
And to me, that's a little bit like inhaling and exhaling, mm-hmm, exchanging oxygen in the lungs. To me, it's very healthy.
Yep.
And it's a structural thing. It sounds kind of mundane, but I do believe that it's a significant factor.
It is. Yeah, I've been in both situations, you know, and you probably have too. You've been in the once an elder, always an elder setting, and then for our purposes, where it's more like you take a mandatory sabbatical, and then if the church says yes, come back in, you know, continue to help serve the church, great. But being in both situations, they both have their pros and cons. But from where I stand, this system has more pros to it, and it's healthier long-term in the life of the church. That's it. But it's not. There's one more thing. The one more thing that's going to make up the rest of this class are the conversations that we have from here. In your small groups, keep talking about these things, the resilience, commitment to resilience, intergenerational dynamics, being authentic, welcoming people to be themselves. Keep talking about it. When you go out to eat with each other, when you're meet and eat groups, when you spend time together, if you talk to each other on the phone, encouragement cards, emails, whatever it might be, keep talking about these things, because this, you know, whether this, whenever I taught this at ACU or for our purposes, much more explicit here, this is the opening of a conversation. This is not a class where here's some material. Oh, wasn't that interesting? What are we doing next week? By the way, we don't have class next week. But keep talking about this, because again, this is the opening of a conversation, and this is just the start. But thanks. It's been fun.